Case number 13-1220, Verizon et al. Petitioners v. Federal Communications Commission et al. Ms. Walker for the petitioners, Mr. Welch for the respondents.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Helgi Walker for petitioners Verizon and AT&T. Part 32 of the FCC's rules require incumbent carriers to maintain an entire set of accounting books that the agency rarely, if ever, even looks at. Under the FCC's own test for forbearance under Section 10, there is no current federal need for Part 32 as applied to price cap carriers. These rules were designed in the 1930s.
Well, even under your theory, that's an overstatement, isn't it? What about the poll attachment?
We don't believe that that is a current federal need for these rules. These rules were designed to implement rate of return regulation in the 1930s. In the 1990s, the FCC moved to price cap regulation. I'm sure I don't need to explain to this court that the shift from rate of return regulation to price cap regulation obviated the need to examine the costs of incumbent carriers' service.
Well, the Commission says it still needs to do that if rates are challenged.
So that argument, Judge Tatel, was not preserved in the order on review.
And because it was only in a big footnote?
There was a passing reference in footnote 209 where the Commission used very noncommittal language.
Yeah.
It said that costs could be necessary in the future. That's neither a serious argument, nor is it sufficient under the FCC's own precedent to use that as a reason to deny forbearance. In the three prior forbearance orders, the trilogy from 2008, the FCC said on each occasion, and even in Section 3B3 of this order, that a speculative future need, potential need for information, is not a current federal need within the meaning of Section 10.
Counsel, let me ask you a question about sort of basic administrative law question. What are we talking about here? Are we talking about a proposed modification to a rule? Is this a rulemaking proceeding?
No, Your Honor. This is actually an adjudication. Congress adopted Section 10 as part of its deregulation strategy, as Judge Tatel put it in the 2001 AT&T case, 2006, excuse me. And what the Congress...
That's okay. I couldn't possibly correct you, whether no matter which year you used. I can't remember the case.
I believe it was the 2006 AT&T opinion where you reviewed a forbearance case and you just said that Section 10 was part of a deregulation strategy.
No, I remember the case. I just don't remember the date.
In the 96.
Yeah. I've read the opinion.
I remember the case, just not the date.
I'm sorry.
I've read the opinion more recently because Judge Taylor wrote it. And I don't recall that he specifically answered the question whether this was an adjudication.
Oh, no, Your Honor.
All right. Now I'll tell you why I think you may be wrong. Doesn't this only have future application? By referring to a forbearance.
Future application, but what Section 10?
Wait, isn't that correct? It only has future application.
That's true. Yes.
And isn't the divide in the APA between rulemaking and adjudication totally in light of the Supreme Court cases as to whether or not a particular action of an agency has future application or retroactive?
Isn't
that the definition?
That's correct.
And it's retroactive if it's adjudication, and if it's prospective only, it's rulemaking.
That's correct.
So why isn't this rulemaking?
Well, I think it's more in the nature of an adjudication, but I'm not sure it matters, Your Honor.
It may matter because if you agree that this is, I'll put aside the question of whether it matters. You think it may well be a request for rulemaking, a modification of a rule.
Well, technically what the Commission does under Section 10 is it forbears from the enforcement of
a rule. That's the same thing as modifying the rule so as not to apply to your clients.
Well, technically the rule continues to exist, but the FCC does not enforce it. That's the mechanism that Congress created in Section 10.
But it's only future.
It is only future.
So therefore, I see it under APA as a rule. And our review of an agency, our scope of review of an agency's decision whether to engage in rulemaking or not, is much more limited than it is with respect to an adjudication.
Well, I think, for instance...
Isn't that fair?
That is fair, but Section 10 is a unique animal.
It is
Your
a unique
Honor.
Animal. It's got more bite than the classic rulemaking. That's fair, but it's still a rulemaking.
But there's a specific test for necessity under Section 10 under this Court's precedence. The Commission has said, and this Court agreed in CTIA, that there has to be a strong connection between the rule at issue and a continuing need for it to advance the agency's regulatory objectives.
I'll tell you why it may have an impact here, because the agency, the FCC, has said that it wishes to take up the issue that you raised in a rulemaking.
So that is flat.
If this was an adjudication, they couldn't do that under AT&T versus MCI. But since it's a rulemaking, they can do that. They can say, okay, this is a request for a rulemaking in forbearance. We don't want to address it here because the conditional forbearance was only presented in letters after the initial petition. But we want to take up the question in a separate rulemaking.
That is an interesting theory, but it's foreclosed by the two AT&T decisions that were specifically about Section 10 that this circuit handed down in 2001 and 2006. What Judge Edwards said first and then Judge Tatel said secondly is that under Section 10, which has time limits and which was meant to be largely deregulatory, the agency cannot kick the can down the road into a rulemaking. It has an obligation to decide whether the rules before it are necessary today, and it cannot simply defer that. That would entirely gut Section 10. And if I could get back to the core question, under the Section 10 test that applies in this circuit, there is no current federal need. The agency has, in three prior opinions, said that means it cannot be a speculative future need, and there has to be a strong connection between the rules. Possibility we might need information in the future is not a reason to deny forbearance. In the 2009 Verizon decision, Judge Sentell put it well. And the problem here is, one of the core problems is, that the very factors that the agency says in this order prevent forbearance were the same factors that did not prevent forbearance in the three prior 2008 forbearance orders. Those are concerns about 272. I'm sorry.
You'll finish your sentence.
Those were concerns about 272 that the agency previously said we can fix with compliance reports, concerns about 254, which the agency said previously we can fix with annual certifications, and concerns about general rate making. The Commission said squarely in the AT&T cost accounting order, the first of the series, those incentives are gone now that there's no connection between costs and prices anymore.
Suppose there's a complaint. The biggest argument the agency makes with respect to the continuation of 32, as opposed to relying on GAAP, is that if there's a complaint, we think we would need 32 in order to respond to it.
I would refer you to paragraph 21 of the 2008 cost assignment order, where the Commission said, with respect to access rates, that if there's a problem in the future, we can exercise our authority under 220C to get any information we need to deal with a complaint under 208. That was deemed sufficient on not only three prior occasions in 2008, but in this very order. In Section 3B3 of this order, the Commission extended that cost assignment relief to mid-size price cap carriers, and it repeated the entire theory that had previously relied on. Once we move to price cap regulation, we really don't need to look or have any information about cost. To the extent there are concerns in the future, we have a more targeted way of dealing with that. We can exercise our general authority under 220C to demand production of this evidence in a possible rulemaking. The Commission said
in a rulemaking?
They said it as to both. They said it as to a complaint. I misspoke. And then they also said if we ever need this information in a rulemaking, it can be provided in comments. But 220C is the answer, was the agency's own answer, Your Honor, on four prior occasions. If that was sufficient before, it cannot now be insufficient.
Does that cover the poll attachment, too?
In general, yes. What the commission said about pole attachments in the 2008 Quest, ARMUS, pardon the acronym, reporting forbearance measure, was that pole attachment data, well, that problem can be solved by simply asking the carriers or requiring the carriers to publicly file pole attachment data. That narrower resolution, as opposed to making carriers keep an entire slew of 164 cost accounts that have no other purpose.
Wait a minute. Now, here's a problem, because the initial petition here did not suggest a conditional approach.
We believe that all of Part 32 is frankly useless in a day where we're not rate of return regulated anymore.
Let's assume, arguendo, that the pole attachment material is, excuse me, that 32 is relevant to the pole attachment question because that's still cost-based. All right, let's assume, arguendo, that's true.
Right.
But don't we have a real problem with your position then, because you didn't raise the suggestion, your client didn't raise the suggestion of a conditional approach here until after the initial petition. And don't we have a case squarely in point?
I think you have a case that actually favors us, Judge Silberman.
And what about Feature Group West versus FCC?
I'm not aware of that case.
Per curiam, 2011.
I don't think we rely on it. I believe we're not allowed to even cite per curiam opinions in our briefs, Your Honor.
I don't think he means unpublished.
I'm sorry. You're right.
Per curiam all the time.
You're absolutely right.
That just obscures who wrote it.
I have a three-part answer.
In that case, we specifically, incidentally, the panel in the case, Judge Tatel, Griffith, and Rambo. You don't think we should ignore it because Judge Tatel was on that panel. In that case, we specifically said the FCC was entitled to ignore subsequent letters, that you had to have them in the original petition.
So, three-point answer to your question, Judge Silberman, because this is important. We filed a global petition for forbearance because all of Part 32 is relevant. But accepting that pole attachment data might be relevant, that's no reason to keep all the rest of the accounts. A rule that is, by the agency admission, about 93% useless is the very definition of arbitrary and capricious.
Your client didn't raise it until he wrote letters lately received. In the past, the FCC has said, we're not going to pay attention.
Second part of my answer is that nobody alleged that our ex parte was late. It was still filed before the close of the statutory period.
The FCC in the past has said that these letters coming in then, not late, but then after the original petition is not the matters we're going to look at.
So what happened, Judge Silberman, was that very close to the end of the statutory period, the agency started to get busy on the petition, probably because of the deemed granted timeline. The staff raised concerns about, for instance, pole attachments. We went in to try to constructively suggest ways it could work around that. Just as it had done in the prior forbearance orders. We were trying to have a constructive dialogue about that.
It looks
that.
Like you're going to lose, so you have a fallback position.
Well,
and the FCC says your fallback position has to be right in the outset petition.
Well, they had plenty of time to consider the suggestions. They just chose not to.
They have said in the past.
They have said that in the past, but that doesn't mean that it's right, especially when their own precedent said, this is the 2008 cost assignment order, that where a narrower approach is feasible, we lack the authority under Section 10 to continue to maintain the rule.
Let's suppose the agency in the past has said, and we have approved, that we're not going to look at letters that come in late.
It wasn't late.
That they're not part of the original petition. We're not going to, now, under those circumstances, is it legitimate for the FCC to say, okay, but they do raise an issue that we're going to take up in a rulemaking?
Under this court's Verizon opinion in 2004, authored by Judge Ginsburg, that is not appropriate. The FCC there tried to reject a narrowing of the issues that were on which forbearance was sought that was filed the day before the close of the statutory deadline. And what the court there said was that it was irrational to say that that somehow changed completely your original request for forbearance. What Judge Ginsburg explained was that it was a mere narrowing of the original request for forbearance, that the issues addressed in the submission, and again, that was one day before the close of the statutory period, were, quote, a mere subset of the original petition. That rationale applies here.
In this case,
we were just addressing.
I referred to you that on what Judge Dettel said on the panel, he said the FCC determined the feature group failed to raise adequately this partial forbearance request in its initial petition. And we approved the FCC rejecting
it. Your Honor, if the FCC doesn't get started on its job in time, and then only raises its own concerns at the 11th hour, and we try to address those, that doesn't make the agency's order that ultimately denies forbearance from a single word of Part 32 rational or reasonable or consistent with its own understanding of what Section 10 requires.
Related, it seems to me that related to this issue is also the question of burden of proof.
Yes.
Which you have mentioned, and you spent a lot of time on in your brief. I mean, if you're right that the commission has the burden of proof here, then, I think I understand your point about partial forbearance. But if you're wrong about that, if you have the burden of proof, isn't it pretty clear that you can't prevail in this part of the case?
I would disagree respectfully with that, Judge Cato.
I mean, you, at the last minute, you ask the commission to forbear on everything else in Part 32 other than the two provisions you asked for forbearance on and got, right? And under your theory, the commission has the burden within the one-year period, which was about to run out, of justifying all the rest of Part 32, right? That's your theory.
Judge Tatel, they had to justify why they didn't forbear from with conditions from those particular regulations, those accounts that went, say, for instance,
the
whole attachment.
But they said it was too late and insufficiently specific. And if you have the burden of proof, if the petitioner has the burden of proof, I just don't see any basis for a reviewing court to second-guess that kind of
the judgment. Basis, Your Honor, is that regardless of the burden of proof, the agency still has an obligation to act reasonably and rationally and consistent with its prior precedent.
Right.
It's not particularly exciting reading, but if you look at all three of those 2008 orders, and if you look at Section 3B3 of this order, and consistent with what this Court has said about acting in a way that makes sense in light of your prior decisions, the Commission has said before that where we can do something narrower, that's what we will do. And on the very subject of poll attachments, it said in 2008 that that can be entirely remediated by carriers publicly filing the relevant poll attachment data. If that was a good enough solution in 2008, why was it not a good enough solution in 2013? That is the epitome of arbitrary and capricious decision-making.
Suppose you had never even presented that in the letters. Would you still be arguing that the commission was arbitrary and capricious, even though it wasn't even raised before them?
If the commission had denied all forbearance relief, yes.
That's not his question.
You would say if the commission had denied it all, even though no one has raised, none of the parties raised the possibility of a conditional approach, that is to say, carving out the poll attachment, you would say it was still arbitrary and capricious.
We would still be arguing it was unreasonable under the statutory requirements as the agency itself has interpreted it. But yes, Judge Silverman, we probably would also be arguing that. But
you certainly would be arguing almost any case. I don't know that.
But here, Judge Silverman, where we pointed it out, that makes the refusal to adopt a narrower approach even worse.
That depends on whether the FCC is legitimate in saying we're not going to look at something that comes in letters late, although it may be a good point. We may take it up in a rulemaking.
Your Honor, with all respect, nobody has said that our filing was late. It was about a month before the close of the statutory period.
They didn't say late. They said late.
What is the dividing line for that? One day, which was not deemed a problem in the Verizon petition, or 6 months? The fact is, Your Honor, that these petitions sit there for a long, long time until the one-year period gets close, and then there's a burst of activity. We heard from commission staff that they had a concern. We tried to address it. I don't think it's right for us to be penalized for that, and then the agency to say, oh, actually, you addressed our concerns too late, and therefore we're going to refuse to forbear from one single word of Part 32, which is about cost-based regulation. We have not been cost-based regulated for over 20 years, and yet
Council,
we still...
Council, let me go back to the burden of proof question.
Yes.
Why, how can it be anything else but the burden of the petitioner? Assuming this is a modification of rulemaking, which I think it is, and we discussed it before, always a modification of rulemaking is a matter that the burden is on the petitioner who's seeking a modification.
Well, again, Section 10, the purpose of it was deregulatory. It was meant to give some relief for rules just like
this.
Is
there anything in the statute which switches the burden of proof?
Not explicitly, but
does it address the burden of proof?
Not explicitly.
So why under even Chevron wouldn't the FCC's interpretation as to who has the burden?
Because otherwise Section 10, which was meant to be a vehicle for at least some deregulation, you know, if rules that don't apply even to the kind of regulation at issue can still sit on the books under Section 10, then I don't really know why Congress took the time to adopt it, but because Section 10
was... Congress expected a party who wished to gain forbearance would petition for it.
Well, on your theory, we could just ask, we could just file a petition for rulemaking, and it's all the same. But Section 10 was meant to have some extra
10,
bite.
No, you're right. 10 has more bite.
It should have more bite.
It has more bite than the classic. It is a rule modification rule. Clearly has to be.
But to answer your question about
it has more bite. There's no question about it.
Right, it has a time limit, and it has three substantive standards.
Right.
But to answer Judge Silverman's question about what would a sensible burden-shifting regime be or a sensible a burden-proof regime be would be a burden-shifting regime. We come forward with a prima facie case, and the agency should then have to explain why, when presented with a prima facie case, they can keep rules from the 1930s that nobody uses.
No,
nobody uses
you,
this
you
information.
You concede you have a burden of going forward.
We have at least a prima, yes, absolutely, a prima facie case burden.
Burden
we,
of going forward.
Yes, burden of going forward, burden of production, but the agency should bear the burden of persuasion to explain why it actually still needs the rules that it says it still needs. But again, to the extent you're uncomfortable with that, the core APA proposition still stands. If they have said before that this is how we implement Section 10, and these very same issues, poll attachments, 272 and 254, were no impediment to forbearance for rules that just like these.
Why is it unreasonable for the agency to say, since you have the parties you concede that the party seeking forbearance has the burden of production, why is it unreasonable for the agency to say you have to make your case in the initial petition?
So actually there are some very technical rules, Judge Silberman, that the FCC has adopted on forbearance petitions, and they will dismiss your petition as being procedurally defective if you have not adduced a prima facie case. We weren't dismissed for being procedurally defective. By definition, we came forward with sufficient facts and evidence to justify our request.
No, I'm only going to the conditional point.
On the conditional point. Your Honor, the conditional...
If you have the obligation to go the burden of production on the conditional point, why is it unreasonable for the agency to say you have to make that meet that burden in the initial petition?
Because the agency has said in three prior decisions that where something narrower is appropriate, that is how they interpret
Section
10.
They may have the right sua sponte to do it on their own, but the question is, can you oblige them without making it part of your burden of production?
Agency can't unreasonably deny. No, they don't have that right, Judge Silverman, under Section 10.
That goes back to your point as to whether, even if you had never raised this point, it would have been unreasonable for the agency not to sua sponte consider the poll attachment as different.
In line with their own prior decisions, yes, and their own prior understanding of Section 10, which they have said a speculative need is not enough to deny forbearance. We lack authority. We lack authority to maintain rules where there's no current federal need, where information's only, you know, occasionally needed. That's not enough under Section 10, and this court has been pretty strict about holding the agency to its own understanding of statutory requirements unless and until they choose to overrule them, and that hasn't happened here.
Are you arguing that FCC precedent requires partial forbearance of any rule where a more focused approach would suffice.
Yes, Judge Brown. That's what the agency said in the 2008 AT&T cost assignment forbearance order, and in the subsequent orders they said, we agree with AT&T that under Section 10 we are not permitted to maintain overbroad regulations when a narrower approach will do. And here the roadmap for what the narrower approach was with respect to these three alleged concerns, which again are totally subsidiary, don't have anything to do with rate of return regulation, but even accepting that subsidiary needs are okay, the agency had its own roadmap. It was not some big secret how one might conditionally deal with these concerns.
You're saying once they exercise their discretionary capacity to partially forbear, that effectively into the future becomes a mandate that they must do so.
Judge Brown, I take your point. If the Commission had said we exercise our policy discretion or the flexibility we have under the three prongs to do it this way on this occasion, that's fine. I understand that. What the Commission said, though, was Section 10 deprives us of the authority to maintain rules unless we can show a current federal need, and we understand current federal need and the strong connection, as affirmed by this Court and CTIA, to mean something pretty substantial. They didn't pass their own test here.
May I ask you a question? What does it cost your client to comply with 32?
The record evidence, which, by the way, was just as good here, if not better, than in the prior forbearance orders on cost, the record evidence is that AT&T alone spends almost $24 million a year simply to modify accounting programs to match up with Part 32. That doesn't even count the accountants, the reviewers, the problems with closing corporate books every month because you have to reconcile everything with Part 32 first. It's an extraordinarily expensive process for which there are literally no benefits. The agency has not asked for this information from our clients in at least the last 10 years. 10 years. That fact in and of itself is pretty probative that there's no current federal need for this information anymore.
I'm just curious, is there anything that would have barred your clients from filing a new forbearance petition right after this one was denied, including all the conditional proposals in the original petition?
We chose to file a petition for review in this court instead.
Could have done it, right?
We couldn't have done both of those things at the same time, Your Honor. So we chose judicial review.
Okay. Anything else?
No further.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Richard Welch for the FCC and the United States. Verizon and AT&T's position is kind of like that Beatles song, All You Need Is Love. Their position is all you need is price caps. In and of itself, that will ensure just and reasonable rates. There's no other regulation that's necessary. And Ms. Walker pointed to...
Hasn't the Commission basically said
no, that? No, it has not, and that's where I'm going. She pointed you to paragraph 21 of the 2008 AT&T cost assignment forbearance order, in which she says supports that point. I invite you to travel to the next paragraph down, paragraph 22, which is entitled Enforcement, and where the FCC explicitly says, accounting information could be critical to our efforts to enforce provisions of the Act, including sections 201 and 202. Thus, we emphasize our condition that AT&T continue to provide accounting data to be used for purposes of an enforcement action, either a commission, tariff investigation, or a complaint proceeding involving 208. So even in those orders, the Commission was emphasizing that price caps in and of itself...
32 was to remain.
Yes, and
but you never sought.
Pardon?
You've never sought. They never sought 32.
Well, but all of it, she mentioned the three orders that all came out in the 2008... All three of those forbearance petitions were explicitly conditioned on the companies. We will forbear from some of these reporting others, but you will always keep this forbearance.
Counsel, answer my question. Have you ever used this 32 information? What do you say? How do you respond? Let me ask the question. How do you respond to counsel's argument that that 32 information has never been sought?
Well, it is used it is an integral part of the FCC's poll attachment rate regulation.
So your answer, basically, which I took from the brief, is we need it for poll attachment.
Well, that is
we don't need it for anything else.
No, with respect, Judge, it is certainly an integral part of poll attachments. But we identified a number of other areas, including ensuring that rates are just and reasonable.
Wait a minute. Well, you've never asked for it for just and reasonable. You're relying on cash.
Well, there was recently last year, there was gearing up to be a huge tariff investigation of AT&T's special access rates. And the FCC suspended that tariff and was getting ready to ask for a lot of information. And that could very well have included.
They withdrew the tariff. Counsel, you keep interrupting.
I'm sorry.
Part of our record here, what the FCC was getting ready to do. What do you say to counsel's statement that in the last 8 years the FCC has never asked for this information?
Well, I would say that overlooks the deterrent effect of this accounting information. When the carriers have to keep this information in their books, readily available to the FCC, or in the case of poll attachments, that publicly available debt, that keeps them honest. They realize that they need to play by the rules, or they could run into some trouble. I want to come back to this sort of all we need is price caps. In the 1990 price cap order that the FCC issued and initiated price caps for LECs, it made clear in paragraphs 293, 295, and 406, that really all the price cap rules do is they control the initial filing of the tariff. What happens then? It's presumed to be lawful. They get streamlined review, and they're not likely to have their tariff suspended. But the commission has made very clear in those paragraphs that the presumption of lawfulness does not carry forward if there is an investigation or if there is a complaint filed. Then they have to justify their rates on the basis of cost.
But it hasn't happened.
Oh, there have been has it happened recently?
No, in the last 8 years.
I can't cite you a specific example of a 208 complaint involving that. But these are the 201 and 202 core components of the Communications Act are duties and obligations that apply to the carriers right now, every day. And so the commission is charged with making sure that rates are just and reasonable and not unreasonably discriminatory, and that could happen at any time. So this data is very much, it's not only just for poll attachments, it's also for ensuring the enforcement duties of the commission, 254K, 272E3. There are a variety of reasons. Now, there was a lot of discussion about partial forbearance.
What about their argument that, well, they say, look, Part 32 was designed for a different regime. It's totally different now. Let me ask my question. It was totally different now. It's price cap. True, there may be areas in which you need this kind of data, but the commission just hasn't successfully shown why other sources of data, GAAP and other, isn't sufficient. That would be a lot less costly for the carriers to keep.
Okay, and that goes to the question of we'll keep data in regard to GAAP rather than USOA. And the basic...
Excuse me, counsel. I think the argument was not just GAAP, but we have other...
Right.
You have other authority to seek information in the event there's a complaint. You don't need the 32.
Well,
I think she was relying on, she was referring to another statutory section other than...
That may have been referring to Section 220. It is true that we can ask carriers for information, but...
Why isn't that enough, then?
Well, for example, in tariff investigations and 208 complaints, there are strict statutory deadlines on the FCC for when it needs to act, 5 months in many cases. And if you
that's a strict deadline, 5 months?
On some of these complicated issues, it's a very strict deadline. And if we have to go to the carriers and say, we want this, and they have to go take whatever manner they're using, whether it's GAAP or something else, and convert it back into Part 32, that's going to take time. Now, Some of the differences between GAAP and the USOA accounting, first of all, they address very different issues. They have different purposes. GAAP is about
cross-subsidy problem.
That's right. GAAP is about protecting investors. It has nothing to do with protecting ratepayers from unjust and unreasonable rates. And it is a set of principles, generally accepted accounting principles, which allow the carriers to go out and set up their own systems. So AT&T could have one system, Verizon another, Cincinnati Bell a third. So there's no uniformity there. And I think the best example of the difference between GAAP and USOA involves the pole attachment area, and in particular depreciation. Under USOA, the commission has straight-line depreciation. I'm not an accountant, but I'll try to say this as plainly as I can. So if you have an asset with 10 years, you have 10% depreciation every year for 10 years. That depreciation expense gets plugged right into the FCC's formula for determining just and reasonable rates. And, in fact, in their reply brief, they directed you to a 2001 pole attachment order, 16 FCC Record 12103, and particularly Appendix E1. And if you go look at Appendix E1, and I encourage you to do that, you will see that a number of the data that goes into the Part 32 accounts regarding pole attachments goes right into the formula. So if the inputs are changing, that's going to change the output. So under GAAP, they can accelerate depreciation far more quickly than they can under the USA. That's going to increase the depreciation expense that gets plugged into the formula and could affect the actual alter the rates.
Tell me again what USA is.
I'm sorry?
Tell me again what USA is.
USOA stands Uniform System of Accounts.
Yes.
That's what it stands for. I'm sorry for the jargon and the acronyms.
I want to go back to this partial or conditional forbearance.
Yes.
Because counsel said several times that the FCC had agreed or conceded that where there a narrow approach is feasible, that the commission lacks the authority under Section 10 to deny forbearance. And I wonder if you could respond to that.
Yeah, I think that language that she's pointing you to, in those prior decisions, people were saying you may need this type of data in the future for some rulemaking purpose. And what the commission was saying, the fact that we might need it in the future for rulemaking is not enough under Section 10. We need to identify a concrete need now. And we've done that here in this case with pole attachments and with enforcement and the other things. I do not think, let's go back to what they asked for. And there was a lot of discussion about this. And I should say, this was a sweeping forbearance provision. They asked for forbearance from 17 categories of rules. This was just one category. And they got most of what they asked for.
Which is one category?
The Part 32 request was part of one of 17 categories that they asked for. They received relief under the bulk of what they asked for. This order is a deregulatory decision. Now, they didn't get what they asked for in terms of complete forbearance under Part 32. But they shot for the moon. They asked for complete forbearance from day one all the way until the last day. They never asked for partial forbearance. They never said, if you think certain categories are necessary for pole attachments, then keep those and forbear from the rest. They never said.
They did by letter.
No, sir. If you go back and look at those letters, they continue, both of those letters, the April 18th letter and the May 3rd letter, continue to ask for to sweep Part 32 away entirely. We will offer to do a couple of things, a couple of voluntary commitments, to raise your comfort level, but they never asked for partial forbearance. They asked for conditional forbearance. And that came very late in the game. This court...
Wait a minute. What's the difference between conditional forbearance and partial forbearance?
Partial forbearance is you keep some of the rules
right,
on the books.
The pole attachment part.
Right, and forbear from others. What they were asking for is if we will do a couple of things. We'll agree not to raise our inputs.
Wait a minute. I don't understand. What's the difference between partial and conditional?
Conditional is total forbearance subject to certain conditions. Partial forbearance is forbear from part, keep others on the books.
And what? And the conditions were?
Well, they offered a number of conditions late in the process. They offered to keep, to provide annual pole attachment data in accord with GAAP, not with USOA. And as I pointed out, that can be, that can have important implications for things like preemption. They, on the 272E3 imputation point, they said, we'll come up with some sort of ill-defined sub-account or identifier, or we'll figure some other way, rather than just putting the data in the existing Part 32 account for that purposes. Then they came back on the very last day and said, we'll agree not to raise the inputs for pole attachments for 3 years. It was time limited. And then they said, we'll continue to collect data in whatever format we prefer for 5 years, but we will pledge to convert it into Part 32 accounts, map it to Part 32 if you ask for it. And those came in very late in the game. There wasn't time for interested parties to comment them. There wasn't time on the, for the FCC to think about all the implications in this interrelated system of accounts. And so the FCC found that they had not met their burden of proof. And if I could just talk about that for one moment, the statute does not speak to the burden of proof. Section 10 says nothing about the burden of proof, as the Tenth Circuit found in the Quest Phoenix case. And when Congress wants to put the burden of proof on the FCC, it knows how to do it. In Section 312 and Section 316, Congress explicitly places the burden of proof on the FCC. And the fact that they didn't do it in Section 10, but they did do it over here, I think is powerful evidence that Congress left a gap for the FCC to fill.
Did the Supreme Court hold in a case, I forget the name of it, but I remember Justice O'Connor wrote it, that under APA, the proponent of an order always has the burden of proof?
Now, I think it's, you're referring to Schaffer versus Wiest.
No, that's not the one.
It's not the one. I'm sorry. But she wrote that. I'm sorry. She
no,
was
another one.
Okay. Well, the Supreme Court has made clear recently that the default rule in American jurisprudence is the person asking for relief, here regulatory relief, bears the burden. And without Congress explicitly addressing the issue, I think it was entirely reasonable for the FCC to conclude, as the Tenth Circuit found, that the burden is on the petitioner. And if I could just, today for the first time at the podium, I heard the petitioners talking about we have the burden of production, but the FCC should have the burden of persuasion. That is the first time I've ever heard that. Their position has been all along, we don't have any burden at all. The entire burden is on the FCC. And to show sort of how that is an unreasonable reading of the statute, I think, that the commission bears the complete burden of proof. They could file a one-page pleading at the FCC saying, dear FCC, please forbear from applying every provision of the Communications Act to us. Sincerely, AT&T and Verizon. And that filing by itself shifts the burden to the FCC to defend every provision of the Communications Act. I submit that that's not a reasonable reading of the statute.
You have been very specific about burden of persuasion and burden of production. So that wasn't really...
Well, we think both components of the burden of proof. I know there's...
What I mean is that prior to the oral argument, neither of you had focused on the difference there.
There was nothing in their opening brief about we have the burden, we concede we have the burden of production. It was like the burden is on the FCC. And to show, just sort of put a fine point on this, the statute became law on February 8, 1996, where Congress included all sorts of new provisions in the statute and told the FCC to go out and do dozens of rulemakings. Under their theory, on February the 9th, they could have asked for forbearance and had the FCC justify all the new provisions that Congress just wrote into law. That is not a reasonable reading of Section 10, I don't think. I think I have covered everything I wanted to cover. If I'll be happy to answer any other questions.
No further questions.
If not, I would thank you for your attention, and I would respectfully ask the court to affirm.
Ms. Walker, I think you or we used up all your time, so you can take two more minutes if you'd like.
Mm-hmm.
to be brief.
What do you think about this point you just made about partial versus that you never asked for partial, you only asked for conditional?
In paragraph 28 of the 2008 AT&T cost assignment forbearance order, the commission said,
Judge Schell's asking you about your letters.
Yeah, the letters. He said, counsel says, your position even up to the last minute was complete forbearance from Part 52, and that the telephone companies would agree as continue providing certain kinds of information as a condition for that, but that there would be complete forbearance from Part 52.
That, we asked for that in the alternative when the commission suggested it wasn't comfortable with some of the particular issues that the data is allegedly useful for.
Is he correct in saying you've never asked for partial forbearance? Right.
That is correct.
Okay. That is correct.
But the reason we never asked for it is because the commission staff never brought it up. No party commented on it. Nobody thought it was a problem until staff affirmatively raised it with the petitioners.
No, but even after they raised it, the staff raised it, you didn't ask for partial forbearance.
But what is the difference, Judge Silverman?
What counsel said, you asked for conditional, i.e., we will volunteer to give you such and such and such. We're still asking for total forbearance. We have not asked for partial forbearance.
It's really two sides of the same coin, Judge Silverman, whether you want to talk about forbearance with the condition, or I suppose the commission could have decided we are going to just carve out Part 32 with respect to pole attachments entirely, but it wasn't really incumbent on us to do that.
Unless you had the burden of production.
Even if we had the full burden, the agency has got to act consistent with its prior precedents. And in paragraph 28 of the 2008 AT&T order, Judge Brown, the commission said, we agree with AT&T that the maintenance of an elaborate and pervasive blanket of regulations constitutes an overbroad method of ensuring 272 compliance. We cannot justify maintaining overbroad cost assignment rules when a more focused approach will do.
Let me go back then to the argument the counsel makes with respect to all of 32. The argument that in the event of a complaint, which is a question I asked you at the outset, we need the 32 information.
So I'm so glad you brought that up because Mr. Welch pointed to paragraph 22 of the AT&T cost assignment forbearance order. That paragraph makes my point better than I could have. It says concerns about needing
which one are you
paragraph 22 of the 2008 AT&T cost assignment forbearance order, which Mr. Welch, my friend, pointed to as a demonstration that the agency has never said they don't need this information. What the commission said in paragraph 22 was, if we need this information in a complaint proceeding, we are comfortable because we have conditioned this relief on AT&T's providing accounting data on request to the commission for use in its proceeding. That's what I've been trying to explain, which is that
in other words, if a complaint came in, you could immediately come up with 32 data. You could translate your gap into 32.
We think we'd be foolish not to maintain data that shows that we comply with federal obligations.
Well,
and the commission said,
"Well, if you're maintaining it, why are you objecting to providing it?"
Because there's lots of easier ways to do that with respect to these particular issues. And yes, we think our gap data
would work. Wait a minute. If a complaint comes in, the agency can ask us for information. Essentially the same information that would have been provided in under 32.
We think it can be derived from our gap accounting data and
that's a fundamental argument because counsel claims that gap data won't necessarily give them what they need for questions like cross-subsidy because, as he points out, and from my prior experience involving accounting, he's right. GAAP is designed for investors, not for rate making.
But in the prior orders, the commission said for cross subsidies, a compliance plan and annual certification is enough. It said that in this order, that's enough. I just don't understand why now there's a substantive problem with alternative cost accounting data when there never was a problem on the four prior occasions that the commission addressed Section 254 concerns.
They haven't received a complaint. And what about his argument that 32 provides a deterrent effect?
We think this court's precedents that we cite in our brief make clear that the agency can't claim there's a problem and then say that there's no evidence of a problem because of the deterrent effect of its rules. That's not rational.
Where have we said that?
I think it's the National Fuel case that's cited in our reply brief.
Doesn't strike me as all that persuasive, but I'll have to go back and look at it.
Okay.
Anyway, I still want to ask the question. I still want to focus again on it. If there is a complaint, are you saying you could easily produce the 32 data?
We think
without providing it routinely.
We think we can produce data to show compliance with Section 254 or Section 272 without recording it in a Part 32 account of revenue or expense. We think we would have that data just not maintained in a Part 32 format.
So, but you're relying on GAAP, Madeira.
GAAP or other data. There's lots of ways to come up with this data, and that's what the Commission said when it adopted compliance plans as a way to deal with 272 and 254 in the prior order. It said, companies, come up with a compliance plan. Tell us how you're going to keep this data. Tell us how you're going to comply with 272 and 254, and that's enough. There's no reason to make you keep maintaining Part 32 accounts, a compliance plan for how you're going to keep this data in the alternative, and let's work on the details.
Wait,
that's
who
enough.
Said this? When?
The Commission. The Commission did in its prior orders. The Commission conditioned its...
Commission never said we don't need 32 data. In fact, what they... In prior orders, when they granted four grants, they said, we're going to keep the 32 data. That's how we protect ourselves.
So what the Commission said with respect to 254 and 272, for example, was a compliance plan is enough, an annual certification is enough, and our 220C power to generally ask you for this accounting data is also enough. So we don't have to kind of sort out all the differences between Part 32 and GAAP. If those solutions were sufficient before, there's no rational reason why they wouldn't have been solutions today, because all of these rules are about rate of return regulation.
Counsel, I might be asking counsel a question. I would like to, if you're through, I'd
oh,
like
you
to,
want to ask the commission?
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
May I address
one
more?
Do you have one other thing you want to say?
I have one other point to Judge Silverman's line of questioning about whether this is a rulemaking or an adjudication.
Yeah.
Judge Silverman, an agency proceeding is not a rulemaking. It has to be prospective, but it also has to be of general applicability. A forbearance petition is only relative to the specific parties before it. So if only Verizon petitions for forbearance under Section 10, only Verizon gets that relief. So I believe I misspoke when I agreed that this is in the nature
I don't think you did
of a rulemaking.
I don't think you did misspeak, because if it's future applicability only, it has to be a rule.
But it has to be of general applicability to be a rule. And a forbearance order is not of general applicability. It governs only the parties who sought forbearance.
I'll have to look at that.
And this court has said on occasion that sometimes adjudications can be prospective or happen.
No. Supreme Court said no.
In any event, forbearance rulings are not of general applicability, so they really are in the nature of an adjudication. Thank you.
Okay. Look, Mr. Welsh, I think Judge Silverman has a question for you.
Yes. What do you say in response to counsel's last point, that the data, if there were a complaint, there are other ways in which you could get adequate data in that event without asking for 32 to be filed?
The FCC was not persuaded by that, and I want to make clear.
But why?
Well, because...
I know they weren't persuaded, but
right.
Why?
They're making vague claims that we can keep it some other way and somehow map it back to the accounts. Why not just keep it in the accounts in the first place? It's not that big a deal. It really isn't. And I want to make clear, because I think this was not clear in the colloquy, the forbearance that was granted in those three orders in the 2008 timeframe were expressly conditioned on them keeping the data and filing the compliance plan showing how they would use that data to comply with the statutory provisions. And we said, but for those two conditions, we would not have ever granted forbearance in the first place.
How did those two conditions get into the case? Did they ask for them initially, or did the commission impose them as a condition of forbearance?
I'm sorry, Justin, could you repeat
how
that?
How did those conditions arise in those cases?
I honestly don't know. I mean,
I mean, did they, in their original petition, say forbear subject to the following conditions, or did they say
I doubt that was
forbear
true.
Forbear and the commission added the conditions?
I suspect it was the latter, that in
but
order.
You don't know?
I don't know the specifics or how it played out. Like, I know how it played out here.
Okay, fine. Ms. Walker, yeah, go ahead.
And I would just say that
Walker, she knows
Part 32 has a much higher level of disaggregation and geographic specificity than GAP does.
One other question on the last point raised. Isn't the forbearance request, if it had been granted, doesn't apply to all dominant carriers?
It applies to everybody they asked for in their petition, and in some places they were asking for forbearance for all price cap carriers, as you suggest. In some places they were asking for it for all local exchange carriers. It kind of depended rule by rule.
So it would be a general rule with respect to price cap carriers, which is another way of saying those with market power.
I think that's right, yes, sir.
Yes, okay.
Yes, sir.
I don't have any doubt it's a rulemaking.
So, okay, thank you.
Well, I hesitate to bring this up, but remember that forbearance also applies to statutory provisions. So it's kind of odd to say that the FCC is engaged in rulemaking when it forbears from applying.
You're better off with the rulemaking than
the truth of the matter is that
it is something of a hybrid. But it's not impossible for Congress to allow an agency to adopt through rules a way of moderating a statute that's done before.
That's true, Your Honor. The commission has not
I know the commission said we don't have to decide that.
That's right.
But we may have to.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Walker.
Thank you very much.
You get the last word in response to a question.
I can answer your question, Judge Tatel.
Okay, good. I don't even have to ask it, right?
The conditions in the 2008 cost assignment forbearance order were adopted sua sponte by the commission. AT&T never asked for those.
Uh-huh.
Also, the supposed condition with respect to Part 32 was not a condition. I would refer you to paragraph 41 of that order, where the commission distinguished, to be sure, it mentioned the continuing applicability of Part 32, but then went on to describe the conditions we impose here. So there was a clear delineation between the assumption that Part 32 would continue to be out there because nobody sought forbearance from it, and the conditions, which were compliance plans, certification, and a promise to give you this information in the event there's ever a complaint filed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.